Is yoga just breathing, stretching and saying namaste and done? Or is there something more on the yoga mat? Why are there so many variations? Where do they all come from? Which flavor is best suited for me? Or should I do them all? Let's get into it.
Welcome to Scale to Fit, Fit in Your 50s. Just show up, make a plan, feel stronger than you can. Small steps lead to victory, you're rewriting history. Scale to Fit, Fit in Your 50s with Marco Lindgren. Come on and join us.
Just like you can use your legs in a wide variety of ways, from a marathon to a Sunday afternoon walk, yoga also covers a wide range of practices. Same spirit, same moves, completely different demands. Today I'm digging deeper into the history of my favorite flavor of yoga, Ashtanga, one of the most structured, athletic and influential yoga systems ever created. I will broaden the view to look at other major styles, Iyengar, Vinyasa, Yin and Restorative, and of course Hatha, which was my first introduction to the mystical and exciting world of yoga. I'll talk about what makes each one special, who they are best suited for, and my favorite part, which styles offer the most benefit for us grown-ups who want to move smarter, not just harder. Whether you've never been on a yoga mat, or you've been practicing for 20 years, I think you're going to take something useful away from today. And as always, here fits as well what I like to say, don't do nothing, do something and scale it back. Before jumping into Ashtanga, let's go back to the source, to a tradition that is literally thousands of years old. The word yoga comes from the Sanskrit root uja, meaning to yoke or to unite, the joining of mind, body and spirit. The ancient sage Patanjali codified much of what we understand as classical yoga in his famous Yoga Sutras, written somewhere between 200 before Common Era and 250 Common Era. Patanjali described yoga as an eight-limbed path, and that number eight, or Ashta in Sanskrit, becomes very important in a moment. In the early 20th century in southern India, a remarkable figure named Tirumalai Krishnamacharya, often called the father of modern yoga, was teaching in Mysore. Krishnamacharya had studied for years in the Himalayas, and he became the yoga teacher to the Maharaja of Mysore, who gave him a yoga hall on the palace grounds. It was here that the modern lineages of yoga we practice today were really born. Krishnamacharya had two star pupils whose legacies you absolutely know, even if you don't know yet their names. The first was P.K.S. Iyengar. The second was a 12-year-old boy named Krishna Patapi Joyce, who in 1927 saw Krishnamacharya give a yoga demonstration and was so transfixed that he walked 3 miles to Krishnamacharya's house the very next morning to begin studying. That level of dedication tells you a lot about what was to come. So, Patapi Joyce, who was he? He became one of the most influential yoga teachers of the 20th century, and the man responsible for bringing dynamic, breath-synchronized yoga to the Western world. He studied with Krishnamacharya for over 25 years, absorbing a system rooted in ancient texts, most notably the Yoga Gurunta, an ancient manuscript attributed to the sage Vamana Rishi. The authenticity of the text has never been fully verified. The original is said to have been badly damaged, but the system it inspired is very much alive. In 1948, Joyce established the Ashtanga Yoga Research Institute in Mysore, India, where he refined and taught the practice daily until his death in 2009 at the age of 93. The torch now passes to his daughter Saraswati and his grandson Sarath, who continued the lineage at the K. Patapi Joyce Ashtanga Yoga Institute, although the community was saddened by the passing of Sarath Joyce in late 2024. The simplest way to describe Ashtanga is that it is a fixed, progressive series of postures called asanas, each linked by breath-synchronized movements called vinyasas. Think of it as a choreographed dance that never changes. The same sequence every single time. There are 6 progressive series in total, each approximately 25 postures. The vast majority of practitioners spend their entire lives in the first and the second series, and that is nothing to be ashamed of. These are physically demanding practices, I can tell. The first series is called Yoga Chikitsa, which means yoga therapy. It is about detoxification and alignment. The second series is Nadi Shodhana, purification of the nervous system. And beyond that, the advanced series, where strength, grace and inner energy control are refined. Each pose is held for 5 breath cycles before moving on. Breath is everything in this practice.
Yes!
3 fundamental tools anchor the practice. The first is Ujjayi Pranayama, a controlled, audible breathing technique. The second is Panta, internal muscular locks that stabilize the core and direct energy through the body. And the third is Dristi, fixed gaze points that anchor focus and develop concentration. Together these 3 form what is called the Tristana method, body, breath and mind working as one. The thing that makes Ashtanga unique is how it's traditionally taught. In the Mysore style, named after the city, students come to the shala or yoga hall and practice at their own pace, self-led, within the group setting. The teacher moves around the room, offering hands-on adjustments and guidance as needed. It's remarkably individual for a group class. Once you have mastered a certain point in the sequence, your teacher introduces or gives you the next posture. There is no rushing ahead. Although, at the same time, for me, getting a new posture was also a kind of achievement, a recognition that my practice had evolved. And thus, not getting a new asana in a while felt a little bit demotivating and disappointing. So deep can the Western achievement culture simmer, even in the most Eastern meditative environment. I hadn't truly internalized the true meaning of the quote from K. Patapi Joyce, which says, "Do your practice and all is coming." Typically, the practice is done 6 days a week, resting on Saturdays and on moon days, a tradition Joyce introduced based on the idea that the lunar cycle would have an influence on the body. Personally, I love this philosophy. Rest is not failure, rest is part of the training. Then let's have a look at the yoga family tree. The founder of Iyengar Yoga, P.K.S. Iyengar, a fellow student of Krishnamacharya's, took the yoga tradition in a fascinatingly different direction. Iyengar yoga is defined by precision, alignment, and the revolutionary use of props. Blocks, straps, bolsters, belts, even chairs and walls are all welcome tools in Iyengar yoga. This approach came partly from the founder's own experience navigating childhood illnesses. He was searching for how yoga could be truly therapeutic and accessible. In an Iyengar class, you hold poses for longer than in Ashtanga, often for many breaths, while the teacher gives detailed anatomical cues to help you find the ideal alignment for your unique body. The teacher training requirements for Iyengar instructor are among the most rigorous in all of yoga, which means you are in highly knowledgeable hands. Vinyasa yoga is in many ways the child of Ashtanga. The word vinyasa in Sanskrit means to place in a special way. And it refers to the principle of linking movement to breath. But unlike Ashtanga's fixed sequence, vinyasa is fluid and variable. Each class can look completely different, depending on the teacher and the theme. It grew out of Ashtanga's framework, but moved away from the rigidity of the series. Today, vinyasa is arguably the most popular style of yoga in Western studios. It tends to be dynamic, creative, and energizing. Because the pace is faster, it suits people who come to yoga with some background in the poses. It builds strength and cardiovascular fitness, as well as flexibility. And from vinyasa came power yoga, a more gym-centric, fitness-focused evolution, popularized in the 1990s. Now, this might be a bit confusing. Technically, Hatha yoga is the broad umbrella term for all physical yoga practices, including Ashtanga and Vinyasa. But in a modern studio context, a class labeled Hatha usually means a slower-paced, beginner-friendly session. Postures are held for several breaths. The focus is on learning correct form, understanding the breath, and developing foundational strength and flexibility. Think of it as yoga at a pace where you can actually think about what you're doing. My first own touch point with yoga was in my teens when I found my dad's book about Hatha yoga. I just followed the pictures and instructions and did my first yoga poses and practice. As I was living in a small village, there were no teachers or studios anywhere, so my first relationship with Hatha yoga didn't last very long, only until the end of the book. After practicing Ashtanga for a while, I tried Hatha again, and at that point it felt just too slow and calm for me. At first I was borderline frustrated, I didn't even get sweaty. Though as the class went on, I was able to connect to my first experiences with yoga decades earlier. Yin yoga stands out as totally unlike everything we've talked about so far. Where Ashtanga and Vinyasa are dynamic, muscularly engaged and heating, what yoga philosophy calls yang practices, yin is the quite opposite. It's a practice of deep, passive holds. Poses are typically held anywhere from 2 to 7 minutes, and the muscles are intentionally relaxed. Yin yoga targets the connective tissue, the fascia, ligaments and tendons around the joints, rather than the muscles themselves. To reach that tissue, you need time and gravity on your side, not muscular effort. Yin draws from both traditional Hatha yoga and Chinese Taoist medicine, working with the body's energy meridians in a way similar to acupuncture. It was developed into its modern form in the 1970s and significantly expanded and popularized in the following decades. If you feel stiff, stuck, or simply overstimulated by life, yin yoga is a powerful counterbalance. And then, last but not least, the restorative yoga. It could be described as yoga's most radical gift to the modern world because it asks you to do something really difficult, absolutely nothing. Restorative yoga was developed from the teachings of P.K.S. Iyengar, who recognized that the body sometimes needs complete support to access deep healing. His student Judith Hanson Lasater later formalized the practice into what we know today. In a restorative class, props are used extensively, bolsters, blankets, blocks, straps, to fully support the body in passive poses held for 5 to 20 minutes. The goal is not to stretch the connective tissue like yin, but to allow the nervous system to shift into its parasympathetic mode, what we call rest and digest, rather than fight or flight. When that switch happens, the body's natural healing mechanisms activate. This work is deep.
Yes!
For all the differences, every style we've talked about shares the same building blocks, DNA, breath, attention, and the intelligent movement of the body in space. They all trace back to that lineage of Krishnamacharya's and Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. They all recognize that how you breathe shapes how you move and how you feel. And they all, in their own way, are practices of presence. The difference lies in pace, structure and intention. Ashtanga and Vinyasa are higher intensity, cardiovascular and building. Iyengar is methodical, educational and precision focused. Hatha is foundational and accessible. Yin targets depth and connective tissue. Restorative targets the nervous system. One style asks you to build heat and power, another asks you to slow all the way down and simply receive. None of these styles is better than the others. They are tools, and the wise practitioner, especially as we grow up, learns to use different tools at different times.
Hey, just a quick note before we continue with the show.
If this episode resonates with you, please share it with someone who might need to hear it. And now, back to the show.
The Good to Know Corner.
During the Ashtanga practice, I often felt that I should already be somewhere else. Somehow, despite the supposed calming and meditative nature of yoga, I was anxious to go through the asanas and be done with it. When I started walking, I never had that same hurry in my mind. The sense of time was different. Also, when I started to train for running, those 2-minute sprints lasted like forever, while the 5-minute walks in between passed quickly. That notion was not my imagination playing tricks on me. That's the brain actively distorting time, affecting the perception of time. Let's start with the big picture. Your sense of time is not a clock, it's not fixed, it's not objective, and it's absolutely not the same for everyone. The sense of time is shaped by your nervous system's alertness, the cognitive work you are doing, the effort your body is exerting, and the depth of your attention. Two athletes can be doing the same sport for the same duration and walk away with completely different experiences of how long it took. There are two main scientific models scientists use to explain this. One is called the scalar expectancy theory. Essentially, the idea that your brain counts internal ticks, and the faster those ticks accumulate, the longer time feels. The other is a striatal beat frequency model, which focuses on neurotransmitters and specific neural circuits in the brain. The bottom line, your physiology, heart rate, body temperature, stress hormones, directly drives your perception of time. When your body is working hard, your internal clock speeds up, and paradoxically, the world around you seems to slow down. Thinking back on my own experience across different kinds of sport, the differences are striking. For example, in endurance sports like marathon running, cycling, or open water swimming, time seems to slow down. Studies show that endurance athletes overestimate how much time has passed during the effort. You feel like you've been out there for an hour, you check your watch, and it's been 40 minutes. That sense of time stretching is driven by physical fatigue, repetitive nature of the movement, and heightened internal bodily awareness. Pain signals, breathing, muscle fatigue. Your internal world gets loud, and that pulls attention inward and away from external distractions, which stretches your sense of time further. Interestingly, this effect holds up even when you add competitors or external distractions to the mix. It's robust. Your nervous system is running its own internal narrative and it's running slow. On the other end of the spectrum, in sprint sports like the 100 meters dash, rowing sprint or high intensity interval training, the experience is almost the opposite. At maximal intensity, time tends to compress. Athletes underestimate how long they've been working, particularly in the final stages of an effort. Overwhelmed by the sheer intensity of the physical demand, the brain processes fewer temporal cues. Less processed information means a shorter subjective duration. The effort was huge, the time felt small. In precision sports like golf, archery, and shooting, top performers describe the moments before execution as time slowing down, almost suspending. This links directly to the quiet eye phenomenon. A longer, more focused final gaze on the target before pulling the trigger or swinging the club. Expert athletes display this far more than novices. It is directly associated with better performance. Their brains have learned to stretch that critical moment out, extracting more information and reducing noise in the system. Mindfulness and attentional training can actively develop this skill. It is not just a natural gift, it's a trainable capacity. In dynamic skill sports like tennis, basketball, or football, the time experience is more complex and context-dependent. You get both compression and expansion of time, often in the same match. This is often described as being in the zone, or flow state, where time appears to slow down during high-pressure moments, giving the athlete what feels like extra milliseconds to read the situation and make better decisions. Neuroscience suggests this isn't an illusion. It reflects genuine increases in information processing speed and heightened sensory absorption. The brain is running faster, so the world appears to slow down. So what's actually happening in the brain across all these experiences? A few key mechanisms keep coming up in the research. First, attention. When your attention is laser focused on the present moment, as in a flow state, time can do strange things in either direction. High arousal generally slows subjective time. Boredom and mental disconnection, paradoxically, can make time track even harder than effort does. Second, fatigue. Physical fatigue slows time, makes everything feel longer. Mental fatigue does something more interesting. It impairs attentional control, which actually leads to underestimating time, particularly in tasks requiring real cognitive effort. Third one, expertise. Expert athletes, regardless of sport, demonstrate more accurate and stable time perception in their domain than novices. Their brains have been trained and rewired through thousands of hours of practice to extract more information from the environment more efficiently, which directly influences their temporal experience. When a great player says the game slows down for them as they improve, that is not a metaphor. That is neuroscience.
Yes!
So, a few practical takeaways.
One,
if long, slow efforts feel grueling and never-ending, that is not a mental weakness. Your nervous system is just doing exactly what it's supposed to do. Strategies that manage interoceptive attention, music, podcasts on easy runs, deliberate dissociation, work precisely because they redirect attention away from the internal signals, which compresses subjective time and makes the effort feel more manageable.
Two,
developing the ability to slow time down in critical moments is a real skill. Mindfulness, practice, attentional training, and deliberate quiet eye routines in precision-based activities can all build this capacity. The athletes who seem to have all the time in the world, they worked for that.
Three,
understanding that your brain's experience of time is a variable, not a constant, gives you a useful frame for navigating the psychological challenges of training and competition. You are not at the mercy of your internal clock. You can learn to set it.
The Good to Know Corner.
Let's take a moment to talk about why yoga would be a real game changer for us grown-ups. A 2016 Yoga in America study found that nearly 14 million Americans over the age of 50 were practicing yoga. And that number had tripled in just 4 years. The research is catching up to what practitioners have known for decades. Yoga is truly one of the most effective and sustainable movement practices for the second half of life. So, what changes after 50? Muscle mass begins to decrease, bone density can decline, flexibility reduces, joints get stiffer, and the risk of falls, the leading cause of injury in older adults, becomes a real concern. And then there's the mental dimension, stress, sleep disruption, anxiety, and the hormonal shifts in the midlife all deserve attention. Yoga addresses all of these. A systematic review and meta-analysis published in the journal Evidence-Based Complementary and Alternative Medicine found that yoga had meaningful positive effects on cellular aging, mobility, balance, and the prevention of cognitive decline in older adults. So, let's get practical. Which yoga styles are the most beneficial for us grown-ups? Here's how I think about it, as someone who is very interested in moving well for the rest of their life. Hatha yoga is an excellent entry point. The slower pace gives you time to understand the poses without the pressure of keeping up with the flow. You'll build foundational strength, learn to breathe properly, and develop body awareness, which is honestly the most underrated fitness skill of all. Iyengar yoga is an outstanding choice for our age group. The emphasis on correct alignment dramatically reduces the risk of injury. The props make poses doable regardless of your current range of motion. A well-taught Iyengar class is essentially an intelligent, personalized anatomy lesson. If you have any existing injuries, chronic pain, or physical limitations, Iyengar is where I would point you first. Restorative yoga is, for many grown-ups, the most transformative practice they've ever tried. It directly addresses the nervous system's tendency toward chronic activation, which contributes to high blood pressure, poor sleep, inflammation, and accelerating aging. Research in the Journal of Clinical Hypertension found that consistent yoga practice reduced systolic blood pressure compared to control groups. It is in the name. Restorative yoga is how you get recovery right. Yin yoga is your secret weapon for joint health. As we grow up, the connective tissue around joints becomes less subtle, which leads to stiffness and reduced range of motion. Yin's long passive holds hydrate and activate the fascia, lubricate the joints, and maintain the kind of deep flexibility that keeps you mobile and independent for decades. And then what about my favorites, Ashtanga and Vinyasa? If you already have a strong yoga practice, there's absolutely no reason why you can't continue with these styles after 50. Many practitioners in their 60s and 70s maintain a beautiful Ashtanga practice. The key is listening to your body and a teacher who understands modifications and your needs. If you are new to yoga at 50, I would recommend building the foundation first before moving into faster-paced flow practices. And then, of course, you don't necessarily have to do yoga on a mat. You can start on a chair. Chair yoga adapts poses using a chair to support, making yoga possible for people with limited mobility, balance issues, joint replacements, or anyone who simply isn't ready for a floor-based practice. The benefits are the same at any yoga practice: improved flexibility, strength, breath awareness, and reduced stress. Don't even think that doing yoga on a chair is any less than some other style. Getting on the mat or the chair is everything.
Yes!
All right, you're inspired or at least intrigued. Now what? Here are my recommendations for the next steps. First, talk to your doctor before starting any new exercise program, especially if you have cardiovascular conditions, osteoporosis, joint replacements, or are recovering from an injury. Yoga is wonderfully adaptable, but your healthcare provider should be in the loop. Second, start with 2 to 3 sessions per week. More is not always better, particularly when you are learning new movement patterns. The general recommendation is about 3 hours of moderate intensity exercise per week for older adults. Most yoga styles, including gentle flow, easily get you there. Third, find a good teacher. An experienced teacher changes everything. Look for studios that offer a range of styles and are welcoming to all levels. Good studios have props available, clean shared equipment, and teachers who offer pose modifications without making a fuss about it. Fourth, don't underestimate the slower styles. Even though I have myself been a competitive, I need to sweat person, I left the slower yoga class quietly transformed. A 5-minute hip opener held in silence does something to the nervous system that no heat session can replicate. And then fifth, yoga is a lifelong practice. There is no finishing it. It doesn't leave you. Patapit Joyce himself taught yoga until he was in his 90s. The mat will meet you exactly where you are, today, next year, and 20 years from now. That is the quiet promise of yoga, and it's one I have found to be entirely true.
Weekly challenge.
From the Royal Palace in Mysore in the 1930s, to your local yoga studio or living room today, the thread is the same. Breathe, move with attention, and keep showing up. The practice is not how the pose looks. It's about how it makes you feel. Whether you're drawn to the discipline and heat of Ashtanga, the precision of Iyengar, the creative flow of Vinyasa, the meditative depth of Yin, or the profound stillness of restorative, there is a version of this practice that was made for you, at every age and every stage. So choose yours and try it out. And remember what I like to say: don't do nothing, do something and scale it back.
Welcome to Scale to Fit, Fit in Your 50s.
And I am Marco Lindgren. Thank you so much for tuning in today. If this episode resonated with you, please share it with someone who might need to hear it. All sounds are made by me except the jingle that was made by Gemini. Send us your feedback via email to feedback@scale2.fit or leave a rating at podchaser.com. Check show notes at scale2.fit. All the links are there.